This is Background Briefing, and I'm Ian Masters, and I'm speaking with Amjad Atallah, who co-directs the Middle East Task Force at the New America Foundation. Previously, he had a Strategic Assessments Initiative, a not-for-profit organization committed to providing legal and policy assistance to parties involved in negotiations in conflict and post-conflict situations, where, among other duties, he prepared scenario planning exercises for the Palestinians and the Israelis. Prior to that, he advised the Palestinian negotiating team on the issues of international borders, security, and constitutional issues, and served as their liaison to the U.S. government in Washington, D.C. Welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Amjad Atallah.
Thanks, Ian.
And this extraordinary cache of documents that was leaked to Al Jazeera, 1,700 files, including emails, memos, maps, minutes of private meetings, and diplomatic correspondence that detail the inner workings of the Israeli-Palestinian peace negotiations, have clearly created quite a stir. People are suggesting it's a sort of Middle East WikiLeaks. How would you frame it?
Well, I think it is historic in the sense that oftentimes these, you know, you've never had negotiations or look at negotiations except usually through the eyes of one of the participants. And so, you know, somebody writes their notes or they write their memoirs about negotiations, and they tend to be a little bit self-serving. These include a significant number of minutes of meetings, and you get a flavor, a real flavor, over a course of time that this was a game the Palestinians weren't going to win. It didn't matter how clever their negotiators were or how many compromises they were willing to make. You really get the sense that no matter what we had done, no matter, you know, even as I'm looking at documents that are online now, that some of which I've written from the early period, you get a sense that we were all engaged in an exercise in futility.
And is that because of the power differential? You're not suggesting it's any lack of negotiating skill. What explains the disadvantage the Palestinians have?
I think the power differential gets it right on the head. The Palestinians were the price for the Palestinians to be in negotiations was that they had to accommodate Israeli security interests. Once you accommodated Israeli security interests, though, the Israelis had no incentive to actually end the occupation. And so you were in this paradox. You see it in a number of the documents. You know, the Palestinians are telling the Israelis, we've done everything you've asked, we've done everything we can to keep you safe, and you're not giving us anything. And the Israelis are saying, yes, you have, thank you. And yes, now we don't feel any pressure to actually give you anything. And so the only thing that could have changed that dynamic would, of course, been an honest mediator that could have compensated for the weakness on the Palestinian side. And again, I mean, I think it's not that there's a smoking gun, but what these documents seem to show over a period of time is that, in fact, across two administrations at least, that the United States was simply unable at any point in time to stand up to, you know, to the Israeli position or to present an independent American position.
Again, I'm speaking with Amjad Atallah, who was an advisor to the Palestinian negotiating team and also served as a liaison to the U.S. government in Washington, D.C. And we're talking about this extraordinary cache of 1,700 files that were dating from 1999 to 2010 that have been leaked to Al Jazeera that reveal the inner workings of the Palestinian negotiating process with the Israelis. And, of course, a lot of it is a lot of the focus on the press has been the extent to which the Palestinian Authority is willing to concede illegal Israeli settlements in East Jerusalem and somehow finesse the Temple Mount issue. And of course, to make compromises on the right of return to refugees, basically, as you've pointed out, details of the security cooperation with Israel, which, as you say, have put them at a permanent disadvantage. at the end of the day, of course, we've had many conversations, and I always try to talk to Palestinians about Palestinian issues and Israelis about Israeli issues. But I must say that, over the years, I'm getting kind of tired of it, because it's not about peace. It's about a process, and a process that, so far has not yielded any results. So are we to then conclude that this is some kind of cynical process?
You know, as somebody who, for some a short period of time was part of it, and somebody who stayed, you know, involved from the outside, I think at the end of the day, my conclusion, it's interesting that even for me, you know, I would have thought that I knew everything, and I would have thought that I had a good grasp of everything that was happening. However, as I'm going through some of these files and the ones that The Guardian and Jazeera had released earlier on Sunday, Monday, and Tuesday, I can't help but feel that the last thing that the Palestinians should do right now is go back into negotiations. That there's simply the negotiation process itself, it's not only that it's useless to the goal of achieving a two-state solution. I actually think that these documents show that it's actually detrimental to achieving a two-state solution. As this process has continued, it's a 20-year process. I mean, the documents they released were from 1999 to 2010, but the process actually began in 1991. And so we're looking at a 20-year process of negotiations that has effectively allowed Israel to completely control and dominate the West Bank. I really think this is a time for a strategic reevaluation on the part of both the Palestinians and the United States. I mean, the Israelis can actually say that everything they've been doing has been working, so I don't know if they need to strategically reevaluate if the goal is to keep all the territory but pay a minimal price politically for keeping it, then they've been doing a great job. But for the Palestinians who want to be free, and for the United States, which wants a two-state agreement, then I think this is a period of time when everybody needs to sit back and say, the charade is over. We're not going to be able to convince even a simpleton that that the negotiations are going to between the Israelis and the Palestinians would lead to an agreement on a two-state solution. So what do we do now? And what we do now for the Palestinians may be very different than what we do now is for the United States. But I think it's a conversation we have to have in both of those in both countries.
Again, I'm speaking with Amjad Attallah, former advisor to the Palestinian negotiating team, and he also served as a liaison to the U.S. government in Washington, D.C. We're talking about the Palestinian version of WikiLeaks, where 1,700 files of inner negotiations of the Palestinian delegations to the with the Israelis have been leaked to Al Jazeera. And while these are not in any way the same as the WikiLeaks, which are cables which have are identifiable, authored, etc., they cover a kind of gamut. So it would take, I think, a lot of judicious assessment on the part of those who read them, right? This is raw data as opposed to...
Yes. I mean, I, you know, this is the kind of stuff that historians have fantasies about, right? You know, that, that they have access to all these files and then they can write a book on, you know, what really happened in those dark days in the 1990s and 2000s when everybody thought there was a peace process, but there wasn't. And you know, that it's really something for the historical record. The thing is, of course, that it's not happening in a vacuum. This leak was released by Jazeera and The Guardian at the same time that there's a revolution going on in Tunisia, that there are major demonstrations taking place in Cairo and in Egypt today, even as we speak. Mohamed El-Baradei, you know, is arriving back in the country. In Yemen, there are major demonstrations now. The context for this is really complicating. The context says that the Arab masses have to hold their governments accountable for the decisions and the actions of their government, and that the United States is neither a pro or it's neither something to help you or to hurt you. The U.S. should just stay out of it. You know, we want independence and freedom in Egypt, and we'll ask for it, and we just want the U.S. to stay out of it. We wanted independence and freedom in Tunisia. We just want the U.S. to stay out of it. I think that the context of these papers at this time might lead people in Palestine to say something very similar. You know, the United States just simply isn't capable, for whatever reason. You can have a conspiracy theory, or you can just say that it's just too big an issue for the United States to wrap its head around. But for whatever reason, the United States simply doesn't know how to play a positive role in the region, and therefore the solution to the problems of the region lie with the people in the region.
And in terms of the people in the region, Amjad Atallah, clearly these governments have sort of looked down on their people. They're autocratic and elitist and remote, living in palaces, etc. And they have not prepared their people in any way for any real understanding of what's really going on behind the scenes, as these leaked documents to Al Jazeera reveal. So, and in many ways, they've used the Palestinian-Israeli agony as a way to justify their own rule. So what is happening? I mean, what I've seen in Tunisia and what I'm now seeing in Egypt indicates a greater sophistication on the Arab street than perhaps observers have noticed before. But so what's your reading on how much the people on the street are not entirely surprised by what they're reading? And does this mean that there's going to be an uproar and more kind of passion and propaganda, or more pragmatism?
Well, I think you're right that, I mean, the irony, I think, of the leaks has been that it's Westerners who are more shocked that the Palestinians had been making all these concessions to the Israelis all along, and that the Israelis had never reciprocated. It's in Europe and the United States that you're hearing, oh my God, the Palestinians weren't the problem. It was the Israelis who never intended to give them two states. That on the ground in Palestine was never a secret. That was never a secret in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. And I think anybody who thought that leaking these or showing all of these would create a backlash against the government in Ramallah, they may be disappointed, because in fact I think everybody knew, you know, even the Goldstone report, the cooperation with the United States to bury the Goldstone report, or even the tacit cooperation with Israel on the Gaza war. These things are part of conventional discourse in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. They're not necessarily a secret. I think it does mean more when you see them on paper. It does make it a little bit, it hurts more. It hurts more as a Palestinian. It hurts more as an individual to see leaders being involved in things like this. But at the same time, it's not a huge surprise. So that's the first thing. The second thing, however, is that it does beg the question, you know, there's been a feeling of hopelessness and despair, that yes, I know these things, but no, there's nothing I can do about it. And again, I think that the sophistication that we're beginning to see throughout the Arab world, and this sophistication may have always existed, we just may never have seen manifestations of it, is that the Arab people are able, in any given context and in any given country, they're able to discern what their own interests are, from the price of bread to employment, to arms sales, to foreign relations. They're able to discern what their interests are. And they've broken the psychological feeling of impotence, that there's nothing they can do about it. And I don't know if the Palestinians have broken, I mean, between the Israeli occupation and the Palestinian Authority's cooperation with that occupation, I think there has been this very strong feeling of impotence among some Palestinians, but not necessarily among civil society. Whether this actually becomes an impetus for change, positive reform, I think remains to be seen. But it's happening all around Palestine, and so there's always the chance that it could happen in Palestine.
But of course, the great disadvantage the Palestinians have is that they are split between the PA and the Hamas. And I've always been mystified as to how incompetent Condoleezza Rice and the George Bush administration were in dropping the ball in that regard, and why they weren't minding the store as the Palestinian authorities ran in those elections that they lost, which, of course, you know, caught Condoleezza Rice by surprise. But at the time, it was pretty obvious that the Palestinian Authority were running a kind of corrupt patronage system, and the much more disciplined Hamas had one candidate per canton. And it, the choice for the average Palestinian was, to choose between, the mafia or the Salvation Army. And guess what? They chose the Salvation Army. So I don't know whether you agree with my analysis, but is there anything in these papers that explain that?
Well, I mean, the U.S. not getting the politics of the region, that seems to be a constant across several administrations. I wouldn't just lay it at the door of the Bush administration. But the on the elections in particular, I mean, I remember a Palestinian Christian friend of mine who was driving me in the West Bank a week before the election told me, you know, I'm going to be voting for Hamas. And I said, really? I'm shocked. I'm surprised. I mean, why would you be doing that? And he said, well, it's obvious that we're not getting two states. And so if somebody's going to be administering the occupation, I want somebody who's not corrupt, you know, doing it. At least there shouldn't be a class of people who are benefiting from the occupation. So Hamas seems less corrupt, and so I'd rather have them running things for the occupation if we can't end the occupation. So when Palestinians voted for Hamas, it wasn't an act of national liberation. It wasn't an act of it wasn't an aspirational move. It was a pragmatic recognition that, in fact, there was nothing the PLO was doing that was going to end the occupation, and an acknowledgement that what Hamas could deliver was not liberation, but it might be able to deliver good governance. That's the message, I think, that was completely missed I have to include myself in the large group of people who sort of missed that part of it. I think that's the piece that a lot of us missed. And it's one thing to miss it the first time. It's another thing. That was in 2006. It's now 2011. It's another thing to not be able to understand what's going on in the region after so many trials. Both the Tunisian government before it collapsed and the Egyptian government right now are trying to frighten the United States by saying, you know, if you don't support us, these horrible Muslim fundamentalists are going to come to power, and they're Al-Qaeda, and they're anti-American, and it's going to be disastrous. So, you know, you have to support our autocracy because that's the only thing that will serve American interests. And that's been a boogeyman that they've played against the United States for far too long. Palestinians were doing the same thing, and the Palestinians in Ramallah tend to do the same thing. Support us because your alternative is Iran and Al-Qaeda. And you, in the minutes, unfortunately, you see a number of times the Palestinian negotiators saying similar things, that, we're the bulwark against Iran, we're the bulwark against Islamic fundamentalism. And, in fact, democracy, tolerance, rule of law, those are the bulwarks against fundamentalism. Bill of Rights, that's a bulwark against fundamentalism. An autocracy that's composed of people who hate Muslim fundamentalists isn't necessarily going to be a successful bulwark.
And Amjad Attali, you mentioned a while ago that you felt that the Palestinians should stop this charade and not negotiate and rethink their position. Does that mean that there is a way for Hamas and the PA to come together and to sort of reassess?
Well, I think that there is certainly a need for them to do that. The problem is that both Fatah and Hamas have had a policy of basically saying we want unity, but only when we can have unity at the other side's expense. And every time there is a scandal related to the Palestinian leaders in Ramallah, they tend to be less willing to have a unity government because they feel weak and they feel that Hamas would be able to take advantage of them.
Well, but
in unity talks.
But these leaks are not going to help in that regard, are they? They're going to. That's
right.
That's salt on the wound.
That's what I'm afraid of.
Yeah.
I'm afraid that it makes the people in Ramallah less likely to want a unity government because they're afraid that they look too weak with their public. And Hamas may in fact think that, we're too strong now. Why would we want to have a unity government with these people who are cooperating with the Israelis against us? And so, I think that that's actually made a little bit more difficult. It doesn't, however, change the fact that the Palestinians don't have a way forward unless they actually recreate a national movement that's composed, if not of every Palestinian, it's at least composed of a majority of Palestinians. And there's got to be some, you know, right now there's no Palestinian official that has a mandate through an electoral process. So there's nobody that's in power, whether in Gaza or in the West Bank, who's in power because of some electoral process. Everyone is there either by decree, their mandates have either ended, or they're there because a PLO system has said, well, by decree, we declare you to be a prime minister. There's nobody there that has a mandate from any population. And I think maybe a first step would be for them to try to, you know, reestablish an electoral process, both inside the occupied territory and outside of it, to develop a constituency, to develop both a constituency and a leadership that's responsible to that constituency. Because then it doesn't really matter what their choices are. They'll be able to argue for them much more coherently. I mean, you can't go into every meeting arguing domestic politics, and this is something that you see in these papers. You know, a third of the time, the Palestinians aren't arguing about where the borders are. They're arguing about what to do about Hamas. And that's not a conversation that you should be having with the occupying power. That's a conversation you should be having with Palestinians.
Well, just in closing, Amjad Atallah, what do you think is going on the Israeli side? Because there was, you mentioned the negotiation started back in 91. There was that period when there was a deal when Rabin was alive. And, of course, Rabin is the political mentor of President Clinton. And President Clinton recently said that he thought that that things were getting to be impossible with the Israelis because of the influx of immigrants from Russia who were all right-wing and xenophobic because of their historical background of being in a under a socialist regime that they hated, and that Israel had sort of irrevocably moved to the right. I'm not accurately paraphrasing what the president said, and he got a lot of heat for it. But my sense is that the idea, and people seem to have forgotten that for a while, Israelis were shopping in Bethlehem. They were going to gambling at casinos in Hebron. They were there was peace on the West Bank, and that seems to be a completely distant memory now. And there's nothing but, you know, money pouring in from Irving Moskowitz out here in Los Angeles from his gambling casinos to build more settlements and just a general kind of, a hard line that somehow we're just going to hunker down and somehow the Palestinians are going to go away. I frankly don't understand what is the right-wing end game in Israel.
Well, I have a lot of Israeli colleagues. I speak with them often. And, you know, I don't want to mischaracterize any particular position. It's always difficult to make a generalization about what the Israeli public is feeling. But I think, in general, you've certainly pointed out the general trend, I think, probably of a majority within the political establishment. It may not be a majority of the entire country, but it's a majority within the power structure in Israel. I remember a conversation I had with an Israeli who would describe herself as being on the left. And I asked her, can you imagine, I mean, she's been working for peace, you know, for many years. And I said, can you imagine the day when there is a peace agreement and all the Arab and Muslim countries open up their embassies on the west side of Jerusalem for Israel and on the east side of Jerusalem for the Palestinians? And she looked at me almost with shock, and she said, I've never imagined that. Even though I've been working for peace, I can't actually mentally imagine what that would look like. And I think that has been a problem for the Israeli left and the Israeli center ever since Rabin was assassinated. I think they haven't been able to imagine what a genuine peace would look like, and it devolved into an almost racist argument that the only reason to have two states was to remove the Gentiles from the Jewish population. And in that argument that you see from Livni in the talks, and that argument that you hear today from Avigdor Lieberman, the Palestinians sort of fell into the trap of trying to accommodate that vision of two ethnic states. And once you started going down that route, the 1967 borders became irrelevant. Then it became about how are we going to include all of the Jews and that are inside the Palestinian state or inside the Palestinian territory into an Israeli state. And for Livni, as we've seen now, she was even trying to figure out how to remove Israeli citizens who happen to be Palestinian from Israel and get them into the Palestinian state. So I think it's really important, even for the Israeli discourse, it's really important for the Palestinians to set up a new discourse. Because, in effect, the Palestinians have been responding to the Israeli one. The Israelis tell us, we don't want too many Arabs living with us. And the Palestinians say, fine, give us a state, and that way we don't have to live with you. That was the wrong response. And maybe the right response is, you know what, you have a right to be here, we have a right to be here. We all have equal rights under international law. You have a right to self-determination. We have a right to self-determination. We've got to figure out how all of us can exercise those rights in a way that doesn't prejudice each other. And that's going to be a difficult conversation, I think, for the Israelis to wrap their heads around, particularly for those constituencies that are firmly wedded to an ethnic superiority model. But I think that's the direction the Palestinians have to go in, and that's the discourse that the Palestinian leadership is going to have to develop. I don't know if the current cast of characters can do it, but no matter what, they're going to have to expand their circle anyway. I mean, there are only five people who've been involved in the negotiations consistently for about 20 years. And, you know, in the United States, you know, we usually replace people after 2 years. You're not allowed to negotiate for 20 years without change or without... Well, actually, no, I'm sorry. There's an exception to that rule. We have one individual who's been involved in the peace talks since 1991 in the United States government, of course, Dennis Ross. So he would be the one equivalent in the United States to the Palestinians who've been involved for 20 years. And I do think that it's to the benefit of people like Saab Erekat if, in fact, that circle is widened, because it's not fair for one individual to have to carry the burden of this on their shoulders individually.
And indeed, there ought to be some meritocracy here, that people should not continue their tenure based on failure. I thank you so much for joining us here today. Amjad Attallah.
It's my pleasure. Thanks, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Amjad Attallah, who co-directs the Middle East Task Force at the New America Foundation. Previously, he served as the Palestinian advised the Palestinian negotiating team on the issues of international borders, security, and constitutional issues, and served as their liaison to the United States government in Washington, D.C. Thank you so much, Amjad. I really appreciate it.
Thanks, Ian.
Bye-bye.